even getting used to the potato harvest. He stayed mentally alert by talking to myself. They are the words of a man embittered by the fortunes of war, of an unrepentant Nazi who has yet to come to terms with being on the losing side. "It is probably hate that dries my tears," he wrote, dismissing Auschwitz with a gloss acquired over nearly 30 years of skulking around South America as an episode to which there is nothing to be added. It is natural and understandable that the camps were suffering very bad hunger after all the problems, and therefore what I saw was to be expected. Mengele was also resentful that while he, a medical doctor, was forced to work on a farm picking potatoes, the occupying American troops plundered Germany. The Crusaders, as he called them, had an unbelievable conscience. While Mengele worked on the Fischer farm, his bitterness was always simmering. Alois Fischer recalls an incident in which Mengele's frustration boiled to the surface. "There was only once a small dispute. He, who was supposed to work as a laborer, gave me an order that I should take the hay down from the threshing fork. I told him he should do it himself. Then he got very angry, only for a short moment, but very much so. He looked at me with great fury. I actually thought he would attack me. But then he completely controlled himself again, and such a thing never happened again." Mengele took his mind off matters by playing mental games. In a menacing echo from the past, he revealed in his autobiography how he used to perform scientific selection on the potato crop. "One had to take a scientific approach to sort out the edible, fodder, and seed potatoes. The frequency of the various sizes followed the binomial distribution according to the Gauss diagram. The medium sizes, therefore, are the most plentiful, and the very small ones and the very big ones are much less frequent. But since they, the fishers, wanted more medium-sized potatoes, I moved the border of the selection for the potatoes for consumption accordingly. And in this way, I obtained more potatoes for consumption than usual. In this way, my mind was kept active. In this way, my mind was kept active." The great selector of Auschwitz had been reduced to selecting potatoes. Although degrading for the high-minded Mengele, this low profile helped him to stay free. His role as a farmhand avoided attracting any attention. Throughout this time, Mengele's morale was sustained by visits to his doctor friend, Wieland, who lived in nearby Riedering. On his day off, Mengele brought wild flowers for Wieland's wife and received any medical treatment he required from Wieland himself. And Mengele's family, convinced of his innocence, made trips to Rosenheim to bolster his morale. Maria Fischer does not remember any visits to the farm, but she does remember that Mengele took short walks with increasing frequency over the years to visit his girlfriend. Irena realized that trips to Rosenheim were fraught with danger, since Mengele was a wanted fugitive, she might be tailed, but she weighed the risks in favor of the visits. She concluded that her husband's morale might be very low if he had access to any of the local newspapers and saw what they printed about him. For instance, in her diary entry of October 7, 1945, she wrote, "In the local newspaper there appears his name, and it said, 'With animal-like lust, he saw people die. One would like to laugh. What shall he think if he sees such writings?'" Irena's early visits to Rosenheim were cloak-and-dagger affairs. She made her first trip in the summer of 1946, but only after a test run had been taken by Carl Jr. in order to ensure that American authorities were not following Mengele family members. Once Carl told Irena the trip could be made safely, she left Rolf with Mengele's parents in Gunzburg and took the train to Rosenheim. Mengele, informed by Wieland of her arrival time, walked toward the train station as she walked toward Mangolding. They met near a popular Bavarian holiday resort, the Zinsee Lake. They walked past each other without so much as a nod, and kept walking for several hundred extra yards to make sure they were not followed. Once they were convinced that there was no danger of being caught, they met and spent their time at a local inn. By the end of 1946, Mengele was convinced the Americans had forgotten him, and he became so brazen that he made 2 one-week trips to Outenried to visit Rolf and Irena. Wieland was furious with Mengele for using the Fritz Ullmann identity card on the 2 trips to Outenried. He thought it was too great a gamble. Wieland reprimanded Mengele. "You are being very risky with my brother-in-law's identification." Mengele exploded in a rage. He took the Ullmann papers out of his pocket and ripped them up in front of Wieland. "There! Are you satisfied? I don't need them!" he yelled. But Mengele's temper had cost him dearly. Without a set of genuine release papers, he was forced to rely on the forged set for the remainder of his time in Germany. It added danger to his already precarious situation. It stopped his travels from Rosenheim and left Irena's visits as Mengele's only contact with his family. Although Irena intended her trips to serve as a calming influence on her husband, they had almost the opposite effect. The visits served as a reminder that their marriage was under a terrible strain. Rolf believes the marriage had suffered even before the end of the war. "My parents never really had a real marriage. Mother was a happy, joyous person, full of life and very sensitive. Her pretty head was filled with thoughts that really didn't fit with her life in the bourgeois village of Gunzburg." Irena was fast losing faith in her marriage. To compensate for the absence of her husband, she sought male companions. Rolf says, "Not affairs, but she was on friendly terms with several men. That was also necessary, since there was no man in the family, and she needed some protection and help." But when Mengele learned of these friendships, he was furious. According to Rolf, their secret meetings deteriorated into bitter fights. Father was insanely jealous. During their short meetings in the forest, he made scenes that embittered her. She should separate from her acquaintances, he said, and not see her friends. She shouldn't leave the house. He did not appreciate the danger she undertook every time she visited him. It was clear to Irena, the man she married before the war and the fugitive who emerged after it were 2 different people. "I knew Josef Mengele as an absolutely honorable, decent, conscientious, very charming, elegant and fun-loving person. Otherwise, I would not have married him. I came from a good, wealthy family, and I had plenty of opportunities to get married. I think his ambition finally became his undoing." Notwithstanding the tension and deepening rift, Irena visited Mengele almost every 2 months. Mengele, meanwhile, had patched up his differences with Wieland and Annalisa. He complained increasingly to Wieland about the growing war crimes hysteria and the focus on his service at Auschwitz. But any hopes Mengele may have entertained of war crimes retribution being limited to the 22 Nazi principals at Nuremberg was short-lived. In December 1945, the Allies announced that other war criminals would also be brought to trial by the governments of those countries that Hitler had ravaged. In early 1946, Mengele asked Fischer to subscribe to the regional daily Rosenheimer Anzeiger. Between that local newspaper and updates from Wieland, Mengele stayed abreast of the war crimes trials and the growing indictments, with keen interest but an anxious eye. In April 1946, Mengele learned that he had been publicly named in court for the first time. Rudolf Hess, the commandant at Auschwitz, had gone on the stand at Nuremberg to give evidence as chief witness in defense of Ernst Kaltenbrunner, who, as chief of the Reich Main Security Office, had been responsible for administering concentration camps and the program for the extermination of the Jews. Since Hess himself had dutifully implemented his part of that policy at Auschwitz by personally being responsible for the deaths of some 2.5 million Jews, he seemed a strange choice for Kaltenbrunner's defense. It soon became clear that the purpose was to shift much of the responsibility onto Hess, since he made a virtue of his compulsion to follow orders, having been brought up to believe that anti-Semitism was a form of pest control. A third of the way through Hess's evidence, Kaltenbrunner's counsel, Dr. Kaufmann, asked him, "What became known to you about so-called medical experiments on living internees?" Hess: "Medical experiments were carried out in several camps. For instance, in Auschwitz there were experiments on sterilization carried out by Professor Klaubert and Dr. Schumann. Also experiments on twins by SS medical officer Dr. Mengele." Meanwhile, according to Rolf, Mengele noticed that a cult of silence had enveloped National Socialist involvement in medical research. The chief architects, like Professor von Verschuer, had to perform some fairly smart footwork as the clamor grew, from the Allies in general, and the occupied countries in particular, to prosecute those involved in those heinous crimes. The German academic world split into two camps: those who had been tainted by Nazism, but whose excuse was that their involvement was purely academic, and those who were unrepentant and beyond the pale. Von Verschuer skillfully maneuvered himself into the former camp, urging a colleague in 1946, "Let us stay silent about the horror. It is behind us." The final rehabilitation for a man who so enthusiastically secured funds for Mengele's futile work and apprised its nonsensical results came in 1949, when a commission of fellow professors judged him fit to resume his teaching career. "It would be pharisaical for us to regard in hindsight isolated incidents in the life of an otherwise honorable and brave man who has had a difficult life and frequently displayed his nobility of character as an unpardonable moral stain." Just how deeply these learned men probed is open to question, since they even tried to pull an academic veil over Mengele, saying that, "From the available evidence, it is not clear how much Dr. Mengele himself knew during the times in question." No attempt by the West German authorities was ever made to prosecute von Verschuer. Von Verschuer went on to become a distinguished professor of genetics at Münster University, but he never again discussed his involvement with experiments, although his son Helmut raised the issue once or twice. "I tried to put my point of view to him, but it was clear that politically we were very different. My own impression is that my father only got to know what was going on very late in the day, but he never responded when defamatory statements were made against him." Unlike von Verschuer, Mengele could not count on the academic establishment to rewrite history and rally round. Most alarming of all to Mengele, as he lay low on his Bavarian farm, was the spate of trials against Nazi doctors held by the Americans, British, Russians, and Poles. In his autobiography, Mengele showed his bitterness about the trials in a fictional conversation with Wieland. In this passage, Mengele referred to himself as Andreas, a pseudonym he adopted to hide his identity in case the papers were ever discovered. Wieland: "Did you already hear the last of the news stories from Nuremberg?" Andreas: "In the course of the re-education, the German, who is already pathetic as a result of so much deprivation and hunger, hears only about war crimes which he has allegedly done, of the forced labourers, and about the concentration camps, and so on and so on. One must realise that this limelight is only intended to make hundreds of thousands of Germans, including mothers of German soldiers, as well as little farmer women who lost two boys to hunger in a Russian POW camp, accuse the Nazis of these supposed crimes. Although Mengele viewed the trials as nothing more than Allied propaganda, his earlier jaunty confidence that he could convince their courts of his innocence vanished with the news of death sentences against three Auschwitz colleagues. Dr. Fritz Klein, with whom he shared the distinction of being the only doctor able to carry out the ghastly railhead selections without a drink, Dr. Werner Roeder, and Dr. Eduard Wirtz, chief camp physician. Wirtz committed suicide before he could be hanged. The future looked bleaker still when, in December 1946 at Nuremberg, the Americans brought 23 leading SS physicians and scientists to court in the so-called Doctor's Trial. The indictment specified four charges: conspiracy, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and membership in criminal organizations. The accused were alleged to have been responsible for experiments on inmates involving exposure to high altitudes and low temperatures, and ingestion of seawater, experiments with typhus and infectious jaundice, experiments with sulfur drugs, bone grafting, and mustard gas, the collection of skulls of Jews, euthanasia of undesirable racial groups, and mass sterilization. Mengele followed the proceedings with consuming interest, especially when the 7 death and 5 life imprisonment sentences were handed down. Among those hanged was Karl Gebhardt, who directed sulfur experiments on women at Ravensbrück concentration camp. Wounds were deliberately inflicted on victims, and then stuffed with wood shavings and gauze strips impregnated with bacteria to simulate battlefield conditions. Then the effectiveness of sulfanilamide was studied. During an inspection by Reich physician SS Ernst Gravitz, Gebhardt was asked how many deaths had occurred as a result of the sulfur experiments. When told that the answer was none, Gravitz said the conditions did not conform to battlefield conditions. A new set of experiments were then carried out on 24 Polish women, in which the circulation of the blood through their muscles was interrupted at the area of infection by tying off the muscles on either end. Very serious infections resulted, and several women died in terrible pain. In May 1943, the Congress of Reich Physicians and the German Orthopaedic Society had presented Gebhardt with its highest accolade for his grotesque experiments at Ravensbrück. Gebhardt was president of the German Red Cross and doctor to much of Germany's pre-war social elite. His father was Himmler's personal physician. In the dock with Gebhardt was the doctor who actually prepared the wounds, Fritz Fischer. He got only a life sentence. Dr. Karl Brandt, Hitler's personal physician, who also oversaw the euthanasia program, was sentenced to death. At Nuremberg, he attempted to minimize the use of human guinea pigs. Quite independently of what actually happened, the human being has always been used in some form for experimental purposes. The jump from animal experiments to human experiments was, for practical reasons, actually needed. The only female defendant, Dr. Herta Oberhäuser, was given 20 years for injecting prisoners with lethal doses of typhus and jaundice. The significance to Mengele of the verdicts against Fischer, Oberhäuser, and Gebhardt was that he too had conducted sulfur experiments, had injected many twins, mostly children, with typhus, and held absolutely to Brandt's view that experiments on humans were an article of faith. And there was no more forceful advocate of euthanasia and the concept of worthless life than Josef Mengele, as his post-war autobiography shows. One passage justifying to Wieland the existence of concentration camps is especially revealing. "It is necessary for each country to have an institution in case of war, where it can keep elements who are of any danger to the country, foreigners who are assumed to be saboteurs, worthless people willing to do espionage, prostitutes, gypsies, and people who are criminals by profession. They, Jews, belonged to the group of possible enemies of the country who one had to be assured of, because of their internationality, their worldwide organization, their connection even to enemy countries and their intelligence service. This fact alone would be enough to take the measure like the Konzentration. When the top leaders of this international organization, the Jewish World Congress, officially declares war on the Deutsches Reich, then there is no need to discuss the right to collect and keep the Jews in camps. Hitler warned Jews in his speech in 1939 not to stir up the people with war against Germany, that it could end up badly for them." In another of his fictional autobiographical conversations with Wieland, Mengele, as Andreas, even defended the conditions discovered in the concentration camp at the end of the war. Wieland: "Recently, I saw in Munich a film about the concentration camps. It seems that there were terrible conditions there. Even if one disregards the scenes which are not authentic and may have come from newsreels from mass Allied bombings of German towns, the movie shows, nevertheless, without leaving any doubts, that people lived and also died there under catastrophic conditions of malnutrition." Andreas: "Yes, that was probably the case." Andreas really doesn't want to say anything more about the subject, but he finally asks Dr. Wieland, "When do you believe these movies were made?" Wieland: "I assume after the occupation of the camp by the Allies." Andreas: "Certainly not earlier. And thus, you get only information about the conditions that existed at the time the movie was made, or maybe several weeks or months before that, during which the last throes of the war were being staged. Every person who lived through this catastrophe knows the insurmountable difficulties in providing provisions which were prevalent during the last months of the war. The camps necessarily suffered to an extremely great degree under the chaos of the debacle of the collapse, and it was that that led to the conditions as they were shown in this movie." Although Mengele attempted to justify the imprisonment of Jews and the conditions in the camps, other members of the Mengele family were more realistic, and they knew that his capture would mean certain execution. Faced with the prospect of Josef joining his Auschwitz colleagues on the gallows, his father and his wife, among others, tried to dupe the American authorities into believing that Josef Mengele was dead. Their efforts, combined with a lack of initiative and a general inefficiency on the part of the American occupation forces, ensured Mengele's freedom in post-war Germany. Mengele's father, Karl, had moved from an early date to bury his son's tracks. As the former Kreiswirtschaftsberater, or economic advisor, to the regional Nazi party covering the Günzburg area, Karl was placed in custody in March 1946, awaiting Allied denazification hearings. The purpose of Entnazifizierung was to grade party members into categories so that appropriate action could be taken, ranging from criminal charges to police surveillance or even acquittal for those who could prove they had resisted Hitler's tyranny. Twice, Karl Sr. told the Americans that his son was missing in action. On the third occasion, he told them he knew he was dead. While Karl maintained that facade in Günzburg, Irena did the same in nearby Autenried. When military police visited Irena in June 1945, She told them her husband was missing in the Russian zone, presumed dead. But even after she knew he was alive and safe, Irena maintained the game with her friends and acquaintances in Outenride and Günzburg. Afraid that one of them might be an informer to the occupying Americans, she insisted to all that Mengele was missing and probably dead. Letters from Irena to friends at the time state her firm belief I shall never see my husband alive. She even turned up at the local Catholic church dressed in black and asked the priest to pray for the repose of the soul of her deceased husband. For one important section of the American post-war administration, the Chief Counsel's Office for War Crimes, the efforts of Karl Sr. and Irena contributed to the acceptance of Mengele's death. It certainly explains why no attempts were made to expand the investigation, or even to follow Irena or other family members in order to locate the missing camp doctor. One person who believed Mengele was still alive and desperately wanted him tried was Dr. Gisela Perl, an inmate gynecologist who had worked for Mengele at Auschwitz. She witnessed firsthand some of his worst excesses. In January 1947, Dr. Perl wrote to the American authorities offering to give evidence against Mengele after she had read in an article in a New York newspaper that claimed he had been captured. The report turned out to be false, and her letter was lost in the bureaucracy and went unanswered. Then, in October 1947, she tried again by writing to the War Crimes Branch of the Civil Affairs Division in Washington, saying that Mengele was the greatest mass murderer and that she had many important things to tell to awaken the conscience of the world. The response to Dr. Perl is indicative of the general confusion, disorganization, and lack of cooperation among the various arms of the American occupation forces seeking to bring Nazis to justice. This time, instead of ignoring Dr. Perl, the Americans mistakenly assumed that Mengele was among the 40 SS men, including some doctors, then standing trial before the Polish Supreme National Tribunal in Krakow. They replied to Dr. Perl that they had asked Brigadier General Telford Taylor, U.S. Chief of Counsel for War Crimes at Nuremberg, to ascertain the status of the trial from the Polish government representative there. Meanwhile, an official in the Locator and Apprehension Branch in Nuremberg came across an indication in a file to the effect that Mengele was dead. Without cross-checking with any other U.S. government division, Mengele's death was assumed to be established. On January 19, 1948, Telford Taylor replied to Washington, "We wish to advise, our records show Dr. Mengele, sick, is dead as of October 1946. Telford Taylor's response appears to have been based on the results of Karl Mengele's ability to convince his interrogators that his son was dead, as well as Irena's deception in Outenride. The fact that Taylor responded to Washington by misspelling Mengele's name is indicative of the post-war chaos engulfing a war crimes section understaffed, overworked, and unable to make the kind of double checks that might reasonably have been expected in the case of such a monstrous criminal as Mengele. In any event, on February 12, 1948, Dr. Perl was informed of Dr. Mengele's death and thanked for her offer to appear as a witness. There the matter rested until the West Germans issued an arrest warrant almost 12 years later. While Telford Taylor's staff at Nuremberg believed Mengele was dead, another branch of the American administration in Europe thought he was alive. On April 29, 1947, Special Agent Benjamin J. Gorby of the 970th Counterintelligence Corps received information that Mengele had been arrested. His source was one of the many different newspapers circulating at displaced persons camps for refugees. As early as December 1946, press reports indicated that Mengele had been captured by Allied forces. They had begun with reports from Vienna in the Jewish political prisoners paper. Gorby heard that the arrest was reported in a Vienna newspaper and assumed Mengele had been arrested there. Since the 430th Counterintelligence Corps detachment was responsible for the Vienna area, Gorby cabled the 430th CIC in Vienna, asking them to question Mengele with regard to the fate of a group of approximately 20 Jewish children who were alleged to have been removed by him from the Auschwitz camp in November 1944 and taken to an unknown place. Gorby added, "The fact of the removal of the Jewish children from Auschwitz by Dr. Mengele was confirmed to this office by the father of one of the children who lives in..." Illegible. Other parents of the children among the group are still alive and most eager to have news from or about their children. There is no evidence that Mengele was arrested in Vienna, according to an inquiry conducted by the Justice Department's Office of Special Investigation, OSI. Almost certainly, Gorby was acting in good faith on the DP camp's erroneous newspaper story, but he made several assumptions without checking the facts. Mengele's diaries mention no arrest. Irena says her husband was not arrested again after his initial detention in mid-1945. Nevertheless, the public disclosure of the Gorby document in January 1985 by the Simon Wiesenthal Center in Los Angeles had an explosive effect, even though the document itself had been available since August 1983. The result was a series of Senate subcommittee hearings, which led to a directive that the OSI spearhead a special effort to find Mengele. The Army was also urged to inquire as to whether Mengele had ever been in their custody after the war. It was the largest investigation of its kind ever undertaken by the United States government. Special Agent Gorby was not the only person who believed Mengele had been captured by American forces during 1946 or 1947. French government documents, obtained in October 1985, state unequivocally that Mengele had been captured by the Americans in late 1946. According to the French, Mengele was detained, was known to be the notorious camp doctor from Auschwitz, and was released without explanation by the Americans on November 29, 1946. The French claimed that American authorities confirmed the Mengele arrest and release on February 20, 1947. Again, though the documents are superficially impressive, they are unsupported by any evidence in any government file. The French claim that Americans confirmed a 1946 arrest and release. No American detention records reflect such an event. There is no denial that Mengele continued to reside quietly on the farm at Mangolding until the middle of 1948. If he had been captured by the Americans at the end of 1946, he is unlikely to have returned to the U.S. zone of Germany for the next 18 months. Although the source of the French documents is not known, they are mistaken. American confusion was a match for the French. While Telford Taylor's war crimes branch in Nuremberg believed Mengele was dead, his name continued to appear for most of the post-war 1940s on the Central Registry of War Criminals and Security Suspects, CROCAS, a list meant to be distributed quarterly to detention camps. Again, this is evidence of the ineptitude that characterized the post-war efforts to find missing Nazis. The CROCAS system was paralyzed by inefficiency. Since May 1946, CROCAS had been little more than a mailing center in Berlin, the whole operation having moved from its British-run headquarters in Paris following a revolt by the American staff, inept logistical arrangements, and a boycott by the Russians. Few names, if any, were added to the lists sent after the move to Berlin. The fact that Mengele's name remained on them so long after Telford Taylor believed him to be dead is unfortunately typical of the Crow Cass efforts after the war. While Mengele resided quietly in Mangolding, the American efforts to find him were half-hearted and ineffective. Mengele's deep cover as a farmhand may well have been unnecessary. It is incontestable that after the American authorities mistakenly released Mengele from custody in mid-1945, they never came close to finding him, even though he lived in the U.S. occupation zone for another 4 years. The closest authorities came to finding Mengele was not the result of American efforts, but rather a chance inspection by two German policemen in 1946. In his autobiography, Mengele recalled the moment he had his first face-to-face confrontation with authorities since his release from the American detention camp. Two German police came to the farm on a motorbike and a sidecar and asked to talk to the released prisoner of war. Andreas, Mengele, said, "I'm the ex-POW," and was ordered to produce his American release card. Andreas retrieved his card from his room and gave it to one of the control policemen. As they reviewed it, Andreas's alarm abated. After a short look, the policeman handed back the card. Again, one thought how, at that time, any German official had the greatest respect for any document that was written in English and stamped by the U.S. Army. With the exception of that one intrusion by the German police, Mengele's stay on the Fischer farm was uneventful. His major preoccupation was not avoiding his pursuers, but keeping himself entertained. Chapter 4. Flight from Europe. While Josef Mengele was residing quietly on the Fischer farm, Karl Sr. had been released from custody after completing the denazification process. Business at the Mengele factory in Gunzburg was booming. As Karl observed, "There was so much reconstruction going on, there was money to be made from it." One of the biggest money makers proved to be wheelbarrows. By the end of the decade, wheelbarrows stamped with the name Mengele were to be seen at thousands of building sites across the new Federal Republic, and annual revenue was 5.4 million Deutschmarks a year. Nonetheless, Karl complained bitterly to the Allies that they were thwarting his expansion plans because they would not immediately allow his son, Karl, to join him. Like his father, Karl Jr. had joined the Nazi Party. During his denazification process, the Allies were reluctant to release him to an active role in the company, arguing that two former active Nazi Party members should not have influential positions in a large company so soon after the war. It was not until Alois returned home in 1949, after languishing in a POW camp in Yugoslavia, that Karl Sr. had both his sons working for him. The rejuvenation of the Mengele firm was fortunate for Josef, because by the fall of 1948 he had decided that there was no future for him in Germany. The prosperity of the family business would allow Mengele to buy his way to freedom, paying for false travel documents as well as guides who would lead him across Europe and onto a boat steaming towards South America. Mengele had made his decision to flee because he was sure his fate would be sealed if he was captured in Germany and placed on trial. It was true that several doctors as culpable as he had somehow managed to wriggle free. Dr. Renno, one of the two chief doctors of the Hartheim Euthanasia Institute, was excused from standing trial because of poor health. Notwithstanding his apparently imminent demise, Renno went on to live peacefully in the Black Forest for another 35 years. There had also been some remarkable acquittals. Dr. Adolf Pocorni, who had written to Himmler saying, The enemy must be not only conquered but exterminated. Left the doctor's trial a free man, even though he was the architect of the Third Reich's plans to sterilize millions of people in the occupied territories. But Mengele was not prepared to count on having Pokorny's good fortune, and reluctantly the family agreed. By the fall of 1948, Mengele had made up his mind to leave Germany and build a life elsewhere. Argentina was the preferred choice of sanctuary. Although Karl Mengele's firm had no branches there, several business connections had been made that his father thought Josef might develop. And there was a groundswell of Nazi sympathy in Argentina. But it was still regarded as something of a stopgap measure, as Alois later confided to Mengele's school friend Julius Diesbach. The family was convinced that Josef would have to stay in Argentina only until the war crimes fever had subsided in Europe. Karl Sr.'s hope was that when the war crimes hysteria had ceased, Josef would be able to return to Gunzburg and share in the running of the family business. Preparations for the Mengele brothers to take over the reins were made with the announcement in January 1949 that the firm was to be called Karl Mengele and Sons. According to Rolf Mengele, his father returned to the Gunzburg area in August 1948 and hid in the nearby forests until the spring of 1949. The Fischers were not surprised when Mengele suddenly left. Alois recalls, "We always thought that he only wanted to hide and that someday he would disappear. And that's what did happen. Suddenly, he disappeared. He took only his money and the suit he had come with, absolutely nothing else. We were not surprised. We thought that he must have found a better hiding place. We never heard anything from him since then." While in the Gunzburg region, Mengele told Irena that he expected her and Rolf to follow once he had established himself in Buenos Aires. But Irena could not agree to go with him. Rolf describes the predicament in which his mother found herself. "My mother did not want to go into hiding with him. She loved Germany and Europe. The culture was dear to her, as she had studied art history, and she was close to her parents. Also, in 1948, she had met Alphonse Hakenjoos, later to be her second husband. Yet, still it was a very difficult decision for her, because she still had feelings for Josef. She made a conscious effort to erase his picture from her mind and terminate her feelings for him." Spurned by his wife and wanted by the Allies, Mengele fled the smouldering embers of Nazi Germany in the spring of 1949, alone and bitter that his fight to save his country from destruction by the Jews had been thus rewarded. Mengele's flight was arranged and paid for by his family through former SS contacts in the Gunzburg area. The escape across the Alps involved plenty of cloak and dagger, but very little of the clockwork precision that mythology has ascribed to the Masonic-like brotherhood of post-war Nazi escape groups. The journey began by train to Innsbruck. Mengele was questioned on the way by Austrian customs officers, who asked him where he was from. "Brixen, in Germany," he replied, which seemed to satisfy them. They did not ask to see his identity papers, and they did not question him again. From Innsbruck, he travelled to an inn at Steinach, at the foot of the Brenner Pass, arriving on Easter Sunday, April 17th. There he spent the night, 400 yards from the Italian border, and met the first of five mystery men who helped him at various stages of his journey, and whom Mengele identifies in his diary only by code names. This man was Xavier. The following morning, Mengele rose in the early hours to be led by a guide across the Brenner Pass. 40 years later, the guide's identity is still a local secret, although Jakob Strickner, a wartime SS sergeant, claims to know. "I'm the only one around here who does know," boasted Strickner, but I'm not saying. The need for the clandestine crossing arose after the Mengele family's attempt to obtain a false passport failed dismally. With no experience in dealing in the black market, Carl Sr. paid 7,000 Deutschmarks for a passport, but it was so amateurishly forged that even the dimmest border guard would have been suspicious. The Brenner crossing took Mengele only an hour. In his account of the journey, he says there was a full moon, and that he saw Edelweiss and the basin of the Brenner Pass several thousand feet below. Once on the Italian side, he went to the railway station, waited in the only restaurant, and caught the first workers' train to Vipiteno at 5:45 a.m. On this leg of the journey, the first of several hitches occurred. Mengele mistakenly got off at Brennerbad, thinking he had arrived at Vipiteno. Before boarding the next train, he waited for a crowd to build up so he could walk behind tall people before getting on the train. When he finally got to Vipiteno, before venturing down, he hung back in his carriage until the platform had filled up with passengers. The network providing the escape service had booked Mengele in at the Golden Cross Inn under the name listed on his forged set of American release papers, Fritz Hollmann. There he was approached by an Italian called Nino, who said the code word Rosemary and handed him a German identity card after Mengele gave him a passport-sized photograph. At the Golden Cross, Mengele met a second man whom he called Erwin, and whom his son, Rolf, now assumes was Hans Sedlmeier, a school friend and the family firm's sales manager since 1944. Erwin brought Mengele greetings from his father and cash in dollars for the long journey ahead. He also brought him a small suitcase filled with scientific specimens from his Auschwitz experiments, which he had retrieved from his girlfriend nurse behind Russian lines in 1945. Mengele had a month at the Golden Cross to memorize the travel plan that Erwin had given him. From Vipiteno, he went on to Bozen, where he arrived by train in mid-May. There he met Kurt, who was in charge of the final phase of getting Mengele out of Europe. In his account of this stage, Mengele again spoke of himself in the third person as Andreas, and he described his initial impressions of Kurt. His actions and mannerisms suited his small, round body. There was an industriousness in his walk as well as his speech. Perhaps he was preoccupied with getting through the ordeal in a hurry. Andreas didn't notice anxiety, but something like suppressed animosity. Kurt was reserved, but always obliging. Kurt told Mengele that passage to Buenos Aires had been booked for him on the North King, leaving Genoa in 2 weeks. The ticket, tourist class, cost 120,000 lira, and there was little time to lose. There was one outstanding matter to resolve, an international Red Cross passport, which Kurt confidently said he could acquire from the Swiss consul. "We can get that done today," he said. "Tomorrow we'll take care of the formalities at the Argentine consulate." Mengele met no resistance at the Swiss consulate, where his application was processed by a woman he described as being of riper years. Kurt introduced his friend as Helmut Gregor, a technician who was requesting a passport for passage to Argentina because he had been a prisoner of war or internee. As with any effective cover, the identity that Kurt created for Helmut Gregor had enough similarities to the man who stood before the Swiss official to satisfy her that they were one and the same person, though, as Mengele later remarked, judging by her lack of concentration, she did not seem to care. Gregor was born on August 6, 1911, just 5 months after Mengele's real birth date. His religion was Catholic, as was Mengele's. He was a German citizen like Mengele, although his original nationality was Italian. The real deception, apart from the name, was the statement that Gregor had been born in the Dolomites at Alto Adige and could prove his identity with his identity card issued on April 4, 1948, at Terrameno in Alto Adige, where he claimed to have lived since 1944. Although Mengele's identity papers were stamped authorization to disembark in Argentina, granted as of September 1948, Mengele still needed a current consulate stamp on his Argentine visa. The following day, Gregor went to the Argentine consulate, where he made his application. He met their demand for a 14-day-old vaccination certificate with a phony predated one supplied by a Croatian doctor. Then, the Argentinians raised an objection. The Swiss consulate official had written the issue date for Mengele's passport in the space reserved for the expiration date. It was, therefore, technically out of date. The apologetic Swiss woman reissued his Red Cross passport. This time, the Argentinians promised Mengele a visa, provided he passed a medical exam. Kurt hurriedly took Mengele to the North King's embarkation building, where he was examined. Commenting on the unhygienic conditions, Mengele noted with disgust, "They were looking for trachoma cases using the same glass rod and the same unwashed hands. If one did not have a contagious disease before the examination, one most probably had it after the examination." But there was yet one more obstacle to overcome. Mengele needed an Italian exit visa, and the corrupt official in the immigration department who usually helped Kurt was on holiday. "You'll just have to manage by yourself," Kurt told Mengele, advising him to try to bribe the official in charge with a 20,000 lira note tucked between his papers. The North King was due to sail in 3 days, on May 25th. Mengele was getting desperate. Taking his guide's advice, he made the approach to the official by paperclipping the 20,000 lira note to the inside of the folder containing his forged papers. The official glanced inside the file, peeled off the note, returned to the file, and then, ominously, exchanged glances with another official. At first, Mengele thought the money was just not enough of a bribe. Then he was ordered up 3 flights of stairs, led into a room, and the questioning began. A policeman demanded to know where Mengele's Italian visa was, where he came from. As Mengele later wrote, "A thunderstorm came over Andreas," as he tried in vain to persuade his interrogator that he was an Italian by birth from Alto Adige. Mengele recalled, "The policeman yelled in broken German, 'I don't believe that. I will investigate you.' For the moment he is arrested, that word hits Andreas." Mengele was taken to a cell and ordered to turn out his pockets. $45 are the most interesting part of the contents to the Italian police," Mengele observed. Then he was locked in an iron-barred cage in the hallway. Like a wildcat, he paced back and forth. The obscene graffiti adorning his cell walls seemed to bother him more than almost anything else. As Inge Bian, who examined Mengele's diary for the West German magazine Bunte, observed, "He was so very upset about this. I wrote, 'What's more obscene, these little things on the wall of the cell, or the hills of bones in Auschwitz?'" Mengele was contemptuous of his cellmates, "these disgusting rural rejects," particularly a gnome-like crippled street musician and a morphine-addicted doctor whose withdrawal symptoms Mengele attributed to his constitutional inferiority. Once, the addict reacted so badly that he deliberately broke a window in order to cut his arm on the glass. Unmoved to help or intervene, Mengele later cruelly remarked, "The creator of this action sleeps peacefully in the prison hospital under the comfortable blanket of painkillers he received for his self-inflicted injuries, the sleep of the addict." Of his other cellmates, including an Englishman, only an Italian submarine commander, a fascist like himself, was worth the time of day. "His words," wrote Mengele, "came from the soul of a National Socialist, a man who spoke contemptuously of the communist rabble as the sewerage of the big towns that now controlled Italy." After spending 3 weeks in jail, Mengele lost all hope of escaping. The immigration department knew that his papers were false. They began to question him about Kurt. Who was he? Where could he be found? And how much had Mengele paid for his help? A 4 a.m. call to the Croatian doctor who had given Mengele his false vaccination certificate seemed to seal his fate. There was nothing more, he said, that he could do. Sleepless, Mengele sank into a state of depressed lethargy. The game, it seemed, was up. Then, as was to happen so often over the next 30 years, Mengele's fortunes changed dramatically. Kurt's corrupt immigration official returned from holiday and straightened matters out. "Suddenly they discovered their mistake," wrote Mengele, "and the policeman is unusually friendly and asks Andreas if he is a Jew, and some more questions." Finally, Mengele was freed and granted his exit permit, and to his great relief, the North King was still at the dock. In mid-July 1949, the North King finally sailed for Buenos Aires. Mengele was in a buoyant mood. The immigration official who had rescued him from jail had arranged for him to travel second class instead of tourist at no extra cost. Watching the Italian coastline recede, Mengele made the banal observation, "Waves, all is waves." Then, over the loudspeaker, came the announcement that the ship had crossed the 3-mile zone and was out of Italian territorial waters. Finally assured of his freedom, Josef Mengele retired to his cabin. "So this is how it feels to emigrate," he reflected, as he settled in for a long sleep. Chapter 5. Argentina. Lull before the storm. The North King crept across the South Atlantic toward Buenos Aires at a steady 8 knots, taking more than 4 weeks for the journey. When the ship finally docked on August 26, 1949, it was springtime in the Argentine capital. But for Josef Mengele, the promise of better days ahead was short-lived. From the moment Helmut Gregor stepped ashore, things began to go wrong. Mengele was expecting an acquaintance to greet him at the dockside, a doctor he had met once in 1939, and to whom he referred in his diary as Rolf Nuckert. But the man was nowhere to be seen. As Mengele went through customs, there was another hitch. An inquisitive officer wanted to inspect one of Mengele's suitcases, the one containing his research notes and specimens. The customs agent asked Mengele what was in the suitcase. Mengele matter-of-factly told him, "Biological notes." There was an awkward moment as the port doctor was called in to examine the documents. Not understanding a word of German, the doctor stared at the documents, shrugged his shoulders, and waved Mengele through. Friendless and without a place to stay, Mengele decided to take a taxi to the city center to find a place to sleep. Then he realized he had no Argentine pesos, as he had been unable to change his currency at the port. Cursing to himself, he turned to 2 Italians he had befriended on the voyage. They took him to a run-down hotel called the Palermo, third class, as he noted, where he shared a room with his 2 companions and used a toilet and washbasin down the hallway. Armed with the address of an engineer in the textile business, to whom Mengele's diary also gives a fictitious name, Schott, he went in search of work. On the way to the engineer's office, Mengele passed the Casa Rosado, the presidential palace of Argentina's new dictator, Juan Perón. Admiring the smartly dressed soldiers clasping their swords as they guarded the palace gates, Mengele reflected that tradition, especially military tradition, is still one of the most stabilizing influences in politics, and that it was only the Germans who were doing their best to destroy tradition in their offering of collective guilt. Unhappily for Mengele, when he eventually arrived at the office, he discovered that Schott could not give him a managerial job. He did offer him one on the factory floor, however, as a wool comber. As an inducement, Schott told Mengele that he would be working alongside the grandson of a notable Argentine statesman. Mengele was not impressed on either count and decided to look elsewhere. The experience may have had a sobering effect, even on Mengele's overdeveloped estimate of his own worth. As a farmhand in southern Bavaria, he had already tumbled a long way from the omnipotent post he had held at Auschwitz. But at least he was never far from Günzburg and his powerful family. Now, in his downfall, he plumbed new depths, alone, with a shared pensione room for a home, shuffling around the city in search of a menial job. He finally settled for one as a carpenter, because it came with a room in the Vicente López district of Buenos Aires. The room had no windows, and still he had no privacy, having to share it with an engineer. His roommate, noticing that Mengele's bags included some medical instruments, such as hypodermics, deduced that he was a doctor. At first, Mengele denied this, but he relented after the engineer's daughter became quite ill, and he pleaded with Mengele to stop lying about his medical past and treat the child. Mengele isolated her in the storehouse and treated her with cold compresses to reduce the fever, prescribing a diet of chamomile tea and sulfonamide tablets. Mengele also swore the engineer to secrecy regarding his true profession. Mengele's concern about his medical past becoming public knowledge was just one of the strains that weighed upon him during his early months in Buenos Aires. The trauma of fugitive life in a strange city 6,000 miles from home must have been severe. Since his arrival in South America, he had begun to keep a daily diary, reflecting, in his writings, the many crises he faced. But, for some unexplained reason, his diary stops abruptly in mid-sentence at this point. In a 1975 letter to his son, Rolf, Mengele informed the family that he wrote of his time in Argentina, but the family claims not to know the whereabouts of this part of his diary. The family may have deliberately destroyed it in order to protect the reputations of Carl Sr. and Alois, who, contrary to the family's indignant denials, employed Mengele as a salesman for much of this time. The diary does not resume for another 10 years, until May 1960, the month that Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped in Argentina. Significantly, perhaps, it was also at that point that Mengele ceased to work for the Günzburg firm. Nevertheless, much can be gleaned from the many letters Mengele wrote home to his family. In his early letters, Mengele, although bothered by his fugitive existence, expressed surprise at the ease with which he was settling into Buenos Aires life. By selecting Argentina as his South American country of exile, Mengele had unwittingly chosen a nation so advanced that the culture shock was greatly reduced. By the end of the 1940s, Argentina had become the technological leader of South America, boasting more than half the continent's telephones, televisions, and railway lines. It had enormous natural resources, as well as the healthiest and most literate population on the continent. And whatever Argentina was in 1949, Buenos Aires was a microcosm. It was certainly the most culturally advanced and sophisticated city in South America. There were 18 major daily newspapers, 3 of them in German, The arts were extensively represented. The Colón Theatre, which Mengele frequented, was modelled on the elaborate Paris Opera and presented some of the world's finest classical musicians and operatic performers. Mengele proved to be an avid theatre-goer. To his delight, he found the city had 47 functioning theatres, more than either London or New York. Academically, it was flourishing too, with 6 universities turning out more lawyers and doctors than all the other South American countries combined. Buenos Aires reminded Mengele of Paris. The sculpted plazas, the iron-grey roofs, the diagonal layout of streets intersecting at sharp angles, the impeccably dressed children, the high ceilings over French windows, and the innumerable outdoor cafes in Art Nouveau style. Mengele also discovered a parochial and elitist attitude amongst Argentinians that was reminiscent of that held by the most fervent German National Socialists. The primitives of Paraguay and Peru were held in contempt. Argentinians often said they were travelling to South America when visiting Brazil or Chile. Mengele found the Argentine attitude of superiority comforting, certainly not alien. But despite its rapid progress, in 1949, Argentina was also a country stricken with serious problems. Just beyond the Parisian-style facades could be seen the Villas Miserias, the shanty towns, crammed with 500,000 people enduring the most squalid and degrading conditions. The rift between rich and poor was vast. A cattle aristocracy controlled the nation. These Argentine lords of the land held positions comparable with the aristocracy in the feudalistic Austro-Hungarian Empire, an oligarchy of some 200 families closely interlocked by matrimonial ties, established over several generations of social primacy and aristocratic tradition. Economic conditions were deteriorating. The budget deficit was enormous, unemployment substantial, government salaries in arrears, and tax collections haphazardly enforced. The black market was rampant. For fugitives like Mengele, the scope for bribes was unlimited. The religious climate was also compatible for Mengele. Argentinians were not only passionately parochial, they were religiously conservative, bordering on institutionalized anti-Semitism. The official state religion, Roman Catholicism, was largely represented by an inflexible and intolerant church hierarchy. The church's influence was such that it was able to sponsor a constitutional amendment limiting the presidency of the republic to Roman Catholics, and its indirect political influence prevented Jews from attaining cabinet-level positions until 1951. There were other major advantages to Argentina as a sanctuary. Before the war, a large and powerful German community had firmly established itself. Some schools in the more fashionable suburbs of Buenos Aires actually taught in German. In all but name, these neighborhoods were reminiscent of Germany, and many of their residents held prominent civil and business positions. After Hitler became Chancellor in 1933, two of the city's German newspapers adopted a strong pro-Nazi slant. By the time the German army had blasted its way into Poland, most Germans in Argentina supported Hitler. Nazi sentiment ran so high, in fact, that the Argentine government ordered an investigation into its growth among German Argentinians to determine whether it posed a serious threat. On November 28, 1941, the Investigating Commission on Anti-Argentine Activities concluded that thousands of German immigrants were controlled by the German Reich, and that many of them received financial help from Nazi Germany in order to foment a Third Reich in Argentina. The Commission noted the new Reich's racial policies toward Jews and said that anti-Semitism is a fundamental principle of the new immigrants. The commission provided voluminous evidence to support its allegations. Bank transfers from Nazi accounts in Germany and Switzerland to German front organizations and businesses in Argentina. Organizational charts which showed the Nazi hierarchy and levels of authority in Argentina and the connection to Europe. Dozens of Third Reich pamphlets and periodicals espousing that Argentina be made a Southern Hemisphere Nazi state. By the time the commission issued its report, however, the Argentine government was firmly pro-Axis. Nazi counterintelligence, the Abwehr, had established an active network of agents throughout the country. The proliferation of Allied embassies and business interests made technically neutral Argentina one of the most attractive listening posts outside Europe. During its peak operational period, from 1942 to 1944, the Abwehr employed more than 1,500 agents and informers in Argentina. Most of these agents returned to normal lives after the war, but they provided a nucleus that allowed Nazi fugitives to move freely about the country. Strong and reliable contacts had been forged with the Argentine police and intelligence service. They were contacts that were to prove indispensable to men like Mengele. Behind this administrative labyrinth of Nazi sympathies was Argentina's new president, Juan Domingo Perón. He seized power on June 4, 1943, in a military coup, having decided that Argentina needed saving. Perón had become infatuated with fascism while serving as military attaché to Italy. Mussolini's histrionics and his concept of the fascist corporate state held a fascination for Perón. Once in power, he instituted radical reforms of his own and did more for the working class than had any of his predecessors. Perón thus became a hero to the descamisados, the shirtless ones. While European fascists were symbolized by black and brown shirts, Perón, not to be outdone, said Argentina will be represented by the shirtless ones. Alarmed by his rise to power and his popularity, rival Argentine leaders had Perón arrested in October 1945. After a short exile on the island of Plata, he was released, thanks to the leadership skills of a young blonde radio announcer, Eva Duarte. Despite the best efforts of U.S. Ambassador Sproul Braden, who published a State Department Blue Book documenting Perón's wartime pro-Axis activities and his close personal business ties to leading Nazis, he won the popular election easily in June 1946 and was restored to power. Before his brief exile, Perón had set aside 10,000 blank Argentine passports and identity cards for use by ranking Nazi fugitives. He also dispatched a personal agent, Carlos Pinheiro, to Copenhagen as a member of the Argentine legation to help channel Nazis into escape routes. Pinheiro was not a great success. On December 6, 1945, the Danes expelled him, claiming that he was using his diplomatic status to smuggle Nazis out of Denmark to South America. Although Perón continued to believe that a reconstructed Germany would return to Nazism within a decade to fulfill Hitler's dream of a thousand-year Reich, his reasons for helping escaping Nazis was not just ideological. There was much money to be made as well. Perón was strongly suspected of having benefited from the booty that the Nazi hierarchy had smuggled out of Europe as a post-war nest egg in the event of defeat. From August 1942 through 1944, crates with markings like Auschwitz and Treblinka were sent directly to the Reichsbank in Berlin. The bank's senior clerk, Albert Thoms, said, "The incoming quantities of gold teeth grew by leaps and bounds, as did other valuables. Once we received 12 kilos of pearls in a single shipment. I've never seen such a mass of sparkling baubles in all my life. Reichsbank records show that more than 3,500 ounces of platinum, 550,000 ounces of gold, and 4,638 carats of diamonds, as well as hundreds of works of art, were then packed into special pouches, along with millions of gold marks, pounds, sterling, dollars, and Swiss francs. The treasure was shipped by 6 German U-boats in an operation codenamed Aktion Feuerland, Operation Land of Fire. It was handled on arrival in Argentina by 4 German trustees. Ludwig Freuder, a well-known German-Argentine banker with close Nazi ties. Ricardo Staudt, a prominent Argentine businessman listed as the number 2 Nazi in the State Department's Blue Book. He was also a lieutenant in the Argentine Naval Reserve and the German ambassador without portfolio. Dr. Heinrich Dorger, a former aide to Dr. Hjalmar Schacht, the Nazis' financial wizard, who arrived in Argentina in the 1930s as a representative of German banking interests and later became a consultant to the Argentine Central Bank, and Ricardo von Leuter, an officer of the Banco Alemán Transatlántico.